Namutasa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhasa. Namutasa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhasa. Namutasa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhasa. Buddham dhammam sangham namasami. I think there's a message there. So tonight is the tonight is the your fourth night here. As was said yesterday, the third day, it's your fourth night, but the third day of your stay here, practicing quite intensively. I'm sure certainly more intensively than you do normally at home. And I think you've heard the good news. The third day is about the worst one. And then from then on, things just ease off and, you know, you just enjoy the ride from tomorrow onward. Of course there are. There are exceptions. you might enjoy more than usually, or dukkha can increase. But that's the general sort of report you get from retreatants. And as Lumbu Sumedho said yesterday, you get it not just from what they say to you, but just the way they look, the way you look. The fourth day, everybody's kind of Devada-like, smiling, face of relaxed, the frowns have disappeared, the wrinkle have vanished, almost. And everybody feels just more relaxed and happy just to be with yourself. I was just remembering the chanting tonight. There's a couple of, you know, some passages of this chant we do every day, which I've done for nearly 20 years, almost every day, which really very beautiful and touching. When we recollect the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, and we talk about these three refuges as, well, as first as being our refuge, and then it's the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, sorrow's destroyer. They are bestowing of blessings, and they are. And then in the end, I dedicate this body and life to the Buddha, to the Dhamma, to the Sangha, and in devotion, I will walk in the footsteps of the Buddha, developing the awakened mind. I develop this path of truth. I walk in this path of truth, and I follow the practice of those who have walked before me, who have realized the truth that the Buddha pointed to. So it's the devotional aspect of the practice is perhaps not mentioned so much in Buddhist circles, because it is a path which is more known for its for using the discriminative faculty. It's referred to as a path of wisdom, compassion too. But it's a wisdom path which requires the use of one's intelligence, one's wakefulness, one's discriminative mind. It requires to be able to recognize things, to sort things out, to find out what's skillful and unskillful. And so it is more famous for its for using the discriminative faculties. But I think it's important to remember that the use of the mind to realize through wisdom insights is eventually to come to the point where there is a realization of letting go and a realization of the silent heart, a realization of peace, a realization of the end of all the obstacles that prevent you from leading a life of peace, leading a life which is founded in calm, peace, clarity, joy, happiness, well-being. And to keep to be reminded every day that it is those three refuges, the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, which are referred to as the Buddha being the awakened mind, the Buddha's mind, the potential that we all have in each one of us has to look at life, to approach life from a state of awakening, from a place of awakening, free from conditioning, free from fear, free from habits, free from pain, free, in short. Which is quite a relief after you've been spending 3 days kind of scrutinizing your prison. That which bind the mind, which prevent the mind from being free, from being joyful, from being peaceful, from being at ease, content. And then the refuge in the Dhamma, which is referred to as the teaching of the Buddha, but also the truth discovered by the Buddha. And on a personal level, the truth, that which in within oneself is most echo in ourself in its most truthful way, whatever that may be in each moment. Each one of us can tap into that awareness of truth, which changes. That for me was true maybe 15 years ago. Now it isn't. Things have changed. You know, things which I thought were real and important aren't anymore. So each one of us can actually can contact that truth through the awakened mind. And it's also referred to as a law, a principle of natural law, principle based on harmony, on ahimsa, on non-violence, on respect of nature, respect of all beings. And then the last refuge, the refuge in the Sangha, which is also considered, you know, it's a destroyer of sorrows, bestower of blessings. And as we walk in devotion, following the Sangha, this refuge of Sangha, then we walk in the footsteps of the disciples of the Buddha who have realized the ultimate truth. We become daughters and sons of the Buddha. And this is a path of practice, what we know as the practice, and which is the Noble Eightfold Path. Probably some of you have heard about a path of virtue, the path of practice, and the path of wisdom. Sila, Samadhi, Panya. So we don't always touch that place of devotion in ourselves in regard to those refuges because we are so caught up in our thinking mind, in our discriminative faculty, which is always judging and sorting out things. And that's very useful, but for most of us, it's just gone out of control. We're sorting and judging almost everything, sorting out. As soon as we get hold of something, we immediately get the sort of, you know, the Vajra sword is trying to cut things which don't need to be cut. Try to sort that thing that don't need to be sorted out. Or judge things that, you know, which is not useful sometimes. Because when the heart is in a state of wakefulness, when there's mindfulness and clear understanding of what's happening from moment to moment, then my experience is that there is a profound silence and unity. Somehow, this wakefulness of the mind seems to bring just a unifying feeling to our mind and body. It brings them together and the heart together. And it's an interesting path. I find it very interesting because it doesn't reject the life of this mind and body to realize the truth. Not only it doesn't reject, but it's an essential aspect of the realization of the truth. Mind and body, this is a material we work with. And our approach to this experience of life, which manifests in ourselves, needs to be balanced. We already are so much, so skilled in a way, and also so gifted through our education, through our culture, you know, to think. We're so... Most of the people here in this room, I'm sure, have spent years learning how to think carefully, learning how to discriminate, learning how to remember many things, accumulate a lot of knowledge. So that does not need to be developed any further. That's been done already, some level. You've done that, you've trained the mind to think. You don't need to do that. You need to concentrate your attention on that. But what is missing is often the heart experience, the blessings of the practice, which takes you to a place, a very different place. And you could say this is a result of a realization, a result of the ending, when you can see truly, deeply, profoundly the ending, what the Buddha talked about. There is the arising, all our experiences have the nature to arise, and then they are present for a certain time, and then they disappear. Everything I'm sure you've seen this during these 3 days. I can't imagine that any one of you has seen anything that was not changing. Perhaps the knee in your, the pain in your knees. But I will be very surprised if any one of you have seen that something that hasn't changed. So this wakefulness, refuge in the truth, practice, take you to a place which is not divided, which is not classified in little boxes and drawers. Takes you to a place where you can go beyond, you realize the dimension of your mind and body and the heart, which takes you beyond changes, takes you beyond the experience of constant feeling of instability, which is so frustrating, you know. Most of us take our suffering very personally, as if we've done something wrong. It's extraordinary how we feel so responsible for this very natural experience of instability, anicca, this kind of constant flux of thoughts and feelings, sensation, perception, conception, and the whole thing is constantly in a state of flux. And yet, how many of us just beat ourselves up for this experience of flux, flow, constant change? So it's about time that we put down that burden, feeling guilty for life. As if we feel guilty that life is alive. Isn't it funny? There's life in me. Something wrong. What did I do? I should be dead. Nothing should be happening right now. The Buddha said so. There's nothing. There's nobody there anyway. Nothing. So what's wrong? What did I do wrong for experiencing suffering caused by instability and a constant awareness of change, of insecurity, how insecure life is. Now we realize at a certain level it is insecure because, you know, you may, just on a very mundane level, you know, Ajahn Sumedho was talking about food yesterday, and I thought I'd give this example just about food. You know, you may gorge yourself with eating like a pig at mealtime. It's still very unstable. By the end of the day, you're starving to death, aren't you? Even though you're eating like three people. By the end of the day, you feel like a hungry ghost again. That's very unstable, isn't it? It's a very ordinary thing. Or sleep. You might sleep 10 hours a day. But even, you know, after 5 hours of work or something, you still find that maybe you're very tired. So sleep and food are the you know, very kind of very close to us, and they are a great source of comfort. Also a great source of suffering. So, you know, there is that we are conscious of the fact that we can't rely on anything. And perhaps all these, our existential questions and our great sort of spiritual crisis and, just crisis in general, a psychological crisis, spiritual crisis, emotional crisis, relationship crisis, work crisis, is often just a kind of group karma, a group kind of experience that is often generated through this misunderstanding of the suffering of change. You know, as you work together as a group, you know, unless you have realized the refuge in the Buddha, refuge in the Dhamma and the Sangha, you know, we are very much at the mercy of any old thought that come across our consciousness, any old feeling, any old mood, any old perception. And something in us knows somehow we are just a little bigger than that, a little wiser than just this sort of thing, this kind of person in us, which is just grasping at any old thing, just for comfort and security. You've seen this, haven't you, during 3 days here, you know, away from the ordinary distractions, and which usually just bring the mind to a state of comfortable state of delusion, in which nothing can be heard, seen, touched, contacted, felt. You know, just the kind of level of pleasure that is needed to feel comfortably deluded. And it's the same for all of us. Don't think the monks and nuns are excluded from that experience. You know. So that, I remember one of our teachers in England, you know, saying that delusion actually is the most comfortable, the most secure and comfortable emotional state. It's a thing in us that says, just everything is all right now. Don't wake up, you know, don't. You eating your third packet of biscuits, you know, you say, that's all right, you know, tomorrow you'll fast. Or, you know, you've been sleeping for so many hours, and you know the bell ring, and you put, you know, sleeping bag over your head, and say, oh, another few minutes, and then 3 hours later you're still in there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we all gone through this, haven't we? So what those refuges are pointing to is is the path of the mind itself. Those three refuges are the mind, in the mind. They are there, right here, right there, right now, with us. They're not far away, they're not in England or in France or somewhere out there or on the moon. They are right with us. And because they're so close, in fact, this is why it's so difficult to be conscious of those aspects of the mind. You know, they're so close. It's like the family, you know. We can be wonderful with most people, but when it comes to mom and dad and my brother and sister, then we can't see really the goodness in those people. And yet we can be marvelous with our friends. And it's so close, we can't see the beauty of our own mind because it's so habitual, you know, we've grown so accustomed to ourselves that we can't appreciate truly the beauty of our own heart, which these refuges are pointing to. What are they pointing to? They're pointing to the truth. They're pointing to a mind which is free from delusion, at least temporarily, you know, kind of, you know, free from this kind of binding thoughts and feelings are temporary, and a mind which is committed to a path, to a way of life which is very, very skillful and very beneficial. And you know, as you spend your day, I'm sure many of you have seen that already, because of the proximity of this, we're so close to ourselves and do not have, you know, we're not so capable of appreciating the beauty of our own being. You know, we're much skillful at appreciating other people's beings, but not so much ours. And because of that, you know, we can very heedlessly kind of generate a lot of anger and a lot of frustration towards ourselves instead of being our friends, instead of being a good friend or really a loving friend. You know, it's so habitual to live with oneself in a kind of just bearing with ourselves, rather than enjoying being me. You know, we just bear with that, just a bad bearer, this kind of person that we carry around all the time. And as this morning I was saying that, you know, when you recognize through mindfulness and clearly, comprehending, so when the experience of each moment, when you recognize more and more the changing nature of your mind and your body, then you can relax. You know, you stop grasping, you stop holding to things. And it's very difficult, I know, it's not an easy thing, because the grasping just take place before we even know it. You know, it's like, I keep remember this song of the Beatles, you know, it's like, life is something that happens to you while making other plans. And so that's what the mind is doing all the time. It's like, you know, you may have, you know, life may be wonderfully going on, but you're busy stressing yourself, making other plans. Constantly in a state of stress. And it's not even you doing it, it's just happening. You know, when the Buddha points out to the experience of no self, when through your practice, you know, when you contact the sort of, you know, this the changing nature of your thinking, feeling, and so on, and realize that there isn't a kind of continuous person there who is in charge. Have you found any? I haven't. It's frustrating, really. Because you might have a wonderful sort of feeling, bodhisattva feeling in the heart, and suddenly, in a kind of most, inconspicuous way, you suddenly have all these sort of nasty thoughts rising up in your heart. It has nothing to do with your bodhisattva feelings. So who is who? Interesting, huh? And we can feel quite frightened. You know, how many times I've experienced that, you know, you take refuge in the Buddha, you take refuge in the Dhamma, you take refuge in the Sangha, you feel quite inspired. You feel, you know, got somewhere with your practice. And then, within a split second, like lightning, you know, you suddenly perceive the most horrible thing in somebody, and you start getting really angry. And before you know it, you shouted at someone. Of course, monastics don't shout so much, but you can shout inwardly. You idiot, you know. I'm just being polite now. We've got different words you can use. You know. And so anger has arisen, you know. Anger, rage. even though every morning and every evening you recite this wonderful thing that the Buddha, being a source of blessing, bestower of blessing, destroyer of suffering. And you will walk in devotion, the path of awakening. And then throughout the day you keep meeting this beast that has come careless about the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Mm-hmm. It's committed to something quite different than the path of truth, path of awakening, and the path of practice. And this is, you know, that's the beast that we are kind of, you know, controlling skillfully right now. But often we don't hear the beast sort of, you know, referred to sometimes as the bull in Zen tradition. We don't hear it. It's quite discreet. It's in the background. And it sort of send out sort of nice, sweet messages that seems rational, you know, sensible. And which stop you from questioning anything. You know, the kind of comfort, it just gives you the kind of messages that brings comfort into the heart so that you can feel really just dull enough for not questioning anything or not, you know, not addressing the serious disease that we're suffering from, called avidya, delusion. And this is why, you know, the whole teaching of the Buddha, it's this a vast series of means to come to grip with that illness of the mind. Which is hidden away often, very kind of skillfully, cleverly, rather than skillfully, cleverly hidden away. And it takes an enormous amount of patience to look at the symptoms of this illness. Because most of that illness is actually what you think you are, you know. Most of the programming that avidya sets in our mind is, for most people, is we identified with it. You know, we think this is what we are. When greed or hatred or you know, arises in the heart, can we actually bring into the experience of greed or hatred the light of wisdom, the light of awareness, the light of clear comprehension, so that instead of being a source of further conditioning, further frustration, further dukkha, further pain, it can be transformed into Dhamma. It can be transformed, and then you can stop right there and then creating further karma. Further, you can stop creating more conditions for dukkha to arise again in the future. Further seeds to bear fruit in the future, as dukkha, as greed, as hatred, as delusion. Now, the theory, I think most of us have read enough books about Buddhism, Taoisms, Hinduisms, Sufisms, Christianity, Shamanism, and all the others. You know, we intellectually we understand, most of us have the intelligence to understand the spiritual path, the path of awakening. You know, we, as I said, we've trained ourselves to think to reflect, to know things intellectually, and it makes sense. We're quite good at actually even seeing the heart of many spiritual paths. You know, we are very quite gifted in that way compared to my experience in Asia, where, you know, the Christian don't talk to the Buddhist and the Buddhist don't talk to the Christian, and, you know, it's all terribly compartmented. You know, we as Westerners involved in this practice, we have the gift to see the essence of all spiritual teachings, because we have developed that kind of intelligence that can sort of cut through all the paraphernalia attached to religion, all the rites and ritual and so on. But what is much harder for us is to put down all that intellectual kind of knowledge and start actually doing it. That's the hardest thing. And I had an interesting experience. I spent a couple of years in Thailand, and it was very interesting to face a culture which is so miserably, you know, so disinterested in the intellect. Not only it's disinterested, but basically, if your intellect is working too hard, you're considered crazy there. You know, in the first tradition, especially, you know, because they're committed to looking at thinking as anicca dukkhanatta, and if you take refuge in your thinking, or you start talking too much or explaining too much thing, they think you've just gone out of control, you've gone crazy. It's an extraordinary experience because, you know, I'm just like all of you, Westerner, and I've learned how to talk about myself very sort of, you know, intelligently, you know, to take myself very seriously. And I've learned how to explain to other people, you know, my important problems. And I've learned to explain them in an intelligent way, you know, quoting and so the rest of it. Not just me, but, you know, Deepak Chopra and, you know, Jack Kornfield and, you know, it's not just me, all the great ones as well. Just to sort of convince my interlocutor, you know, more profoundly. And I did that with my teacher in Thailand. And he looked at me absolutely baffled. It was an extraordinary experience because it really showed me the assumption that I had about my mind and my body and me, my personality that I think I am. Because whenever I spoke about my doubts and my, you know, the things about my practice or and so on, he just looked at me, you know, and what's the problem, you know? And it's quite interesting, you know, because it is a Buddhist country, Thailand thinks Buddhist. We think New Age. Over there, they're just very simple. There's only one teaching, Christian, not haven't sort of a strong hold yet. Even though they fear it might happen. But anyway, it's very simple. You have one teaching and you have one way of looking at things, and, you know, and you believe it or not, that's, you know. And you know, psychology is very simple. It's Buddhist psychology, right? Very, very simple. You've got the unskillful mental state. You've got the skillful mental states, states of consciousness. You've got the defilements, the kilesa, you know, and that's it. Anything you say about them is just what they call sankhara, it's proliferation. Anything you can say about the unskillful state of mind or the skillful ones, it's just you're creating a problem about that. Because all you need to know as far as a Buddhist practitioner is that to recognize them, but not to write a book about them. It's a different thing. you know, most of us, we recognize, but we write a book straight away. And we think about it for the next 10 years. Not to mention the insight, you know. When we have an insight, then we become a teacher here. Do you know? When over there, if you have, you know, 20 years of insights, you're still not allowed to teach in some circles, because you don't know anything yet. So it's an interesting contrast. And every time I went to my teacher and I started telling him about my doubts and every time I looked at him and he sort of looked blank. He was blank, blank look. I was being translated, I had a translator, and I began to, I felt a sense of frustration arising in me. I could not explain myself. He could not, you know, me could not get a full, it could not be sort of packaged in this lovely package that was used to. Because we have, you know, this person here, but all the proliferation around it is packaging it so that we actually don't get to it. You know, we're making something out of it, which is incredible. And I saw that during the time when I was in Thailand, that I could not cover myself anymore. I could not hide. You know? And immediately as I started talking about my practice and how things was going on, I began, you know, interested and so on, he just kind of... What's that? It's like you're proliferating again. You're off the track. You've lost the path. And I'm not saying this is the only way, but that was an interesting, such a different way of looking at life. Very, very simple way, which made my, it really was so beneficial for my own mind. Just to kind of, you recognize the defilements, you recognize unskillful mental states, you recognize skillful mental states, you let go of unskillful mental states. You can develop skillful mental states, or you can let them go too. You know? So it's very simple choices like that. Which brings to me, it was so cooling to the heart. So cooling, just very simple. So when I came back to the West, when I went to Thailand, I had the biases of a Westerner, and when I came back to the West, I had the biases of a Thai. I hated all these kind of proliferations. I couldn't even look at books. And whenever Westerners would start telling me about their practice, I just felt like cutting through and saying, this is all rubbish, you know, just be here and now. Stop thinking, stop talking, shut up. Just do it, you know. And having trained as a dancer, you know, it's like, it's so simple, you know, I was aware that the practice more and more is a skill. And it's like in the same way you train as a dancer, you know, you can't just kind of proliferate while you're doing pliés in your bar. And so write a book, you know, as soon as you go out of the studio about the insight you had about that muscle that just went turned out a bit more, you know. Which we do a lot about our practice, don't we? We start writing poetry. I mean, how many, you know, can you imagine if I had to write a poem about every kind of increased turnout I had, you know, in my practice, or the strength of my legs, or the height of my leaps, or... You know, I started writing a book about that. So, I mean, since then, it's about nearly a year now. You're lucky to have me now because I've kind of, you know, the middle way has helped quite a bit. The practice of mindfulness balances things out. So I also, you know, both cultures have good points and bad points. You know, it's like you never get one without the other. Now you've got whatever you pick up, whether it's, you know, this gong or these thoughts or this feeling or this person or this cushion, you know, they all have, that's another insight that I had, is like they all have a very good side and very bad side. Now, because we're so intelligent, we as soon as we think about something, which means the mind holds something, we get all the push buttons that say, it's good because it's not so good. So it's like this kind of push button mechanism of the discriminative mind that can write a whole book about the good effects of something and a whole book about the negative side of something. So that was a profound insight, actually, which I almost forgot. It was like I call profound insight, you forget them usually. It's like whatever you pick up, that's why we are such a wonderful proliferators, you know, is because of this, hyperactive thinking mind, which has gone out of control, it's gone sort of slightly off tangent. We don't know that because our whole culture has gone off tangent at that level. You know, when you look at the computers and all the sort of, you know, just the words. It's a culture of words. And I was saying to my teacher, I was terrified, just thought of going back west, because I said, every time I think of the west, I think of this enormous, vast ocean of thoughts, like swimming in thoughts, you know, diving in thoughts and sinking in thoughts and drowning in thoughts and trying to get out of thoughts. You know. And this image kept coming up in my mind, you know, I can't think I can cope because there's such a lightness and such a wonderful sort of sense of ease when that all these thinkings just come out of the way. And this image kept coming up in my mind, you know, I can't think I can cope because there's such a lightness and such a wonderful sort of sense of ease when that all these thinkings just come out of the way. It's so spacious, it's so light, it's so lovely, it's so kind of joyful not to be obsessed with thinking. And none of you want to be obsessed with thinking, do you? But that's, the conditioning is there. It's programmed. So, having a contrast like that was, helping to balance a bit more, to feel, to realize that, you know, we are part of a culture which is not necessarily a culture we like, even. Not a culture we want to go along with. And yet, we are part of it. We can't separate ourselves from it, you know. And the more you open yourself to it, you can see that you can't pretend to be in a world of no thoughts when everybody around you is swimming in it. Or, you know, is relying on that thinking mind so, you know, tightly. And again, in the same way that, as I said earlier, whatever you hold in your hands or in your mind or in your heart or in your life, it always has the bright side and the dark side. So same, the intellect has bright side and the dark side. Without that intelligence, we would not be able to actually find out what is skillful and helpful and useful and supportive for our practice and what isn't. And as often said to people I teach, you know, if all of us could realize that just spending, just practicing, to simply sort out the skillful from the unskillful, not as an idea or an opinion, but from insight, actually through insight. Because, you know, if we just spend, 10 years just sorting that out, we will make an enormous amount of progress. And I would say not at an intellectual level, but through insight, through actual realization, beyond the thinking mind, beyond the conditioned mind, beyond the habits of our mind. which takes you beyond doubts. You know, unshakable confidence leads you to unshakable confidence in what, that which is skillful and that which is unskillful. And you can see the path of practice is just sorting that out. You know. And it takes a long time, even though the practice is each moment is right here now. There's no sense of time. When there is mindfulness and presence of mind, you are in a timeless space. The time stops right here, right now. Why is future and past? You know, when you are present. But it's like disentangling a huge ball of wool which has been completely knotted. You know, the mind is just like that. It's just completely knotted. And you take one little thread, you know, and the more you pull it, that's what we do a lot of the time. You know, if you ever try to disentangle a ball of wool, you know, the more you rush and the more you try to, you know, unknot the knots, the tighter it gets. You notice that? That's my experience. When I'm in a hurry to, you know, undo the knot, everything just gets tighter. And you make more knots, you know. So that mind is just like that. It's full of knots, full of tightness, full of contractions, full of... So the more you hurry, the tighter it gets. And that's why it's very important to consider, not to see result in terms of, you know, time or years, or, you know, after 5 years I'll be able to, you know, I'll be wise, I'll be able to teach, I'll tell other people what to do. Some people start after 1 year. You know, some people, they do a retreat and then they're ready to teach. And we all have that tendency. I mean, especially when you begin, you are so enthusiastic about your practice that you want to share it with everybody. And what happens is that usually people start wanting to run away from you because you're so enthusiastic. Well, they're not maybe where you are. So it's not a question of time, you know, because I mean, during this winter retreat at Amaravati, you know, my experience of this retreat was very interesting. You know, I had experience that you should not have after 20 years, almost 20 years, you know. I was thinking things I should not think, and I thought almost anything in this life, almost everything you can think of, without any limits. I was, it's probably conditioning from childhood, where I was brought up as a kind of free being, so I could think what I wanted, but still... You know, you think, oh, after some years, you know, things will be really clear, there won't be any problem, I know what to do, I'll know where to go, and I know the path, I know without any doubts, without... And yet the karma is still there, you know, it'll be there until you die. Talk about karma, which means action, you know, the resultant karma of your life. Is still, you know, is operating or constantly is there. It's churning away, and we have this kind of innocent look at life, you know, like a child. I think, you know, when I get this, then think everything will be all right. When I get that, problem will be over, right? Just like with food. See, once I get my breakfast, I'll be fine. And then you come to the meditation hall, and what happens? Fall asleep, or you get really, you got a stomach upset because you've eaten too many toasts, you're still getting over the angry moments you had when somebody, you know, took the piece of something other that you were, looking forward to eat. You know, so you can really see how in our life we have this kind of childish kind of innocence about life, which is, again, you know, like everything, it's got wonderful sides and what makes genius, and also a very unwise aspect, which make you believe that once you've done this, then you'll be all right. You know, once I get over that problem, then my life will be okay. Once I meet the right man, I'll be fine. Have you ever met it? Once I meet the right teacher, then I'll have no problem. How many people are still looking for a teacher? I found a teacher. He hasn't solved my problems. I can even be quite critical, Ajahn Sumedho. Doubt him. You know, it's like, it's not because you have a teacher that suddenly you find the right, you know, everything will be fine. Once I eat the right food, that's a great one, isn't it? Then I'll be okay. But I don't think it works like that. I remember when I was in Thailand, I was just on white rice and cakes and hard-boiled eggs and chilies at 8 o'clock in the morning, and that was it for the day. And if I thought about it from England, I would have died just the thought of it. Would have just about killed me. That's why I never wanted to go to Thailand, I remember. Because I thought I'd probably die anyway there. And yet I spent 2 years just on white rice. And you know what microbiotics thinks about white rice. You're supposed to die after you're supposed to die after 3 days or so, isn't it? And then cakes, which is just about the worst thing you can eat. Thai cakes. And then lots of hot stuff, which is supposed to give you ulcers, and so on. And I was never sick, you know. Because, I know why, because I had different priorities. You know, if I'd gone there for the food and the diet and my health, I would probably got sick within a week. But because I was interested in actually practicing there, something in me just, it's like we have an incredible ability to adapt and to survive. But we have to put ourselves in a place of no choice. As long as we have choice, we can't adapt. And that's where commitment comes into the picture. I wanted to talk about commitment for a long time, but somehow I haven't been able to do that, you know, until now. But the commitment, which is so difficult for us Westerners to think in terms of, you know, committing yourself to anything. And unless you have that, you know, that intention to commit yourself, then you find that you don't receive the help you need. You know? I noticed that as a nun, as a Buddhist nun. You know, the beginning of Citta, so when we started, where I was ordained, I didn't think of commitment because I hated it. Just the thought of, you know, putting myself in a situation for many years was just unthinkable. But there was a commitment there, which I wasn't fully aware. It was a commitment to practice, to see things in the light of Dhamma, to put down things, to end the day, to put things down at the end of the day, to start anew on the next day. And that was supported by the lifestyle. You know, because every day we had a lot of teaching, and Ajahn Sumedho will tell us, you know, to roar, you know, he will kind of roar, his lion roars, you know, do you want to be an arahant or a patujana? You know, and we kind of, oh my God, you know, no, I don't want to be, a patujana is a deluded being in the Pali scriptures. So you kind of shook in your, you know, oh no, I want to be an arahant for sure. I don't want to be the idiot, you know. No, I want to be the arahant really, but I just want to be the idiot, you know. I want to be the one, I want to be the winner. I want to be the one, you know, I'm the arahant. Not the deluded type. So, often we don't, you know, we don't reap the blessings of our life because we don't, blessings, I mean by that, I mean the joy that comes from trusting, that comes from the mind, which is relying not so much on the known, the condition, the habits, but actually rely on the trust, faith, the unknown, you know, that which is uncertain, and so on. There's a tremendous well, you know, spring well of well-being there, you know. And you can see that in people when you put down the fear of the future, you know, and the obsession with the past, then the present moment is a very joyful experience, very light. And that's why the Buddhist disciples will always describe, you know, they do not hanker for the past, they do not worry about the future. This is why they are at ease. This is why they are, you know, happy. And it's a worthwhile thing to consider because all of us are, you know, very, very much seeking happiness. And we're seeking it in areas which are not, you know, which we still don't know maybe the happiness which is not conditioned by any changing experiences, you know. Most of the happiness we know is conditioned by something. You know, you eat something delicious, or you do something very pleasant, or you meet a wonderful friend, or you go and see, you have a really very fulfilling experience of some sort. But you don't, you know, we can we come to the point where we don't need anything to be happy? We don't need anybody to be happy. We can be, like the Buddha said, you know, an island unto ourselves, self-reliant, which doesn't mean that you're not dependent or connected with everyone else. On the contrary, because you're not needing anyone or anything to be happy, then you find that you are close to everybody. You know, because you're not demanding from anyone to make you happy or a situation to make you happy. And then people come to you, they like your happiness. They feel happy when you don't rely on anything to be happy. And that's a great blessing, isn't it? To be able to use, you know, the those refuges, the focus of, you know, focusing on the awakened mind, to see things as they are, the Dhamma, and to develop the mind, to develop the heart, so that you become unshakable, eventually unshakable as to what is worth following and what isn't. You know, in terms of speech, in terms of action, in terms of thinking, in terms of, you know, I was really naive when I started. I thought, yes, speech and action, I can see that's really karma. But even though intellectually I could make sense of the, you know, thought being karma, I was still convinced that it wasn't. It was interesting. Well, now, I tell you, I'm really careful. Not because I repress my thinking, you know, it has its full range, but because I know the results of certain train of thoughts. I know what condition, you know, I've experienced what conditions certain train of thoughts, positive and negative. So to be able to come to this kind of unshakable confidence where you have choice. This is at that place you have choice. Before that, you have little choice. Because it's just happening to you. And the way we receive this happening is we feel emotionally victimized by our mind. And that's very sad. Because we don't have to be a victim of delusion. We don't have to be a victim of greed or hatred. You know, it's not. It doesn't help. It's not helpful on the path of liberation. What is helpful is more. You know, is to come to understand, and that understanding is only possible when you've put down all ideas about how you should be and not be, what you should think and not think, what you should feel and not feel, and so on. When you've put down all assumptions about how you should be or other people should be, and only in that kind of restful place of unbiased, not prepared, willing to see things as they are, free. Only in that place can understanding arise. So an aspect of the practice is just to help the mind to just calm down, cool out. And this is why sorting out the skillful from the unskillful become very important, because what we talk, the unskillful states of mind is that which keeps stirring up karma, keeps stirring up regrets, keeps stirring up anger and frustration and restlessness and so on. All those things do not need to be judged. They do not need to be, you don't need to criticize them, because there's no one there who's, you can't find anybody responsible. It's only karma, resultant karma. And where does it come, how far does it go back? Sometimes you can't trace it back in this lifetime. Why some people make you really upset? You haven't even, you meet them for the first time and suddenly you can feel enraged by them. Even though you think you should have a lot of metta for them. And yet, sometimes you look, you don't feel anything to some people. So, there's no one there doing it. But there is just those states of mind arising and passing away, arising and passing away. And we need the patience, a calm abiding within ourselves, and a non-judgmental mind to be able to see things clearly, like the image of the pond. The more you stir up the mud, the less you can see. And so an aspect of the practice is to stop stirring things. And yet, many of us are quite addicted to stirring things, aren't we? I mean, it took me many years to realize I was really, really committed to chaos. I loved chaos. And I didn't realize it. It became conscious at some point when I was, the karma was obviously on its way out in that sense, when it was quite shocking to me to realize how much I wanted, I was also committed as to, the Buddhist nun with, I'm practicing Sila Samadhipanya and I'm calming the heart and I'm, I want to see things clearly. But then I also saw an aspect of me that just loves stirring up and chaos and, making life interesting. Not wanting to be bored with things. But it wasn't conscious. It took a while to see this really clearly. Just through karma, you can see suddenly the results of that way of relating to things can bring havoc, So it's an aspect of the aspect of practice which is helpful to can just cool out. So you may not be able to control your speech. You can still say four letters word and shout at somebody out of impatience or frustration and so on, but you know, you developing the refuges as the Buddha Dhamma Sangha is also developing that intention in the heart, the intention which is like a, you know, the attention of an awakened being, the intention which is a true intention, you know. So the intention of an awakened being like the Buddha is not to hurt, not to harm, not to act on delusion, not to act on anger, not to act on greed, right? But then the habits still carry on. And you have to integrate that little by little, you know, not contend or fight or struggle or hate or judge or criticize or want to kill, all this, you know, get rid of things. But you have to develop an endless sense of humor in the whole thing, because, you know, I saw this in my early years as an Anagarika when I was a novice. You know, I was a different person, different time of the day. By the end of the day, I was close to arahantship. I was on the verge of full enlightenment, and then each morning I would wake up as a totally deluded, you know, animal, not even a human being. I mean, and then came the meal time, I turned into this total hungry ghost with high ideals. Within 5 minutes, the high ideals were there, and then 5 minutes later, the stomach took over, the taste bud. You know, and they are all little creatures there, sort of, you know, gnawing at you. You don't think taste buds are alive, but they are. I'm convinced. They have their own life. And they can't care about wisdom. They don't care about health. They don't care about anything, in fact. As long as they get a nice taste, that's all they need to survive. If you give them some nasty taste, they can't survive. The program doesn't work anymore. You know, they don't want to be there, which is not nice. Taste buds. So they kind of, you know, recall in the background. You just don't give them what they want for a while. And you can see. I mean, if I hadn't been a nun, I thought I would have gone really crazy. And not that you have to ordain, by the way, to practice. You know, you don't need to, but. You know, it's a very sort of challenging experience to have all these sort of different entities throughout the day, from the great Arahant, Bodhisattva, down to the sort of hungry ghost, and then to the, you know, and then to the Asura, which are the warrior and the fighters. When you suddenly feel you just want to kind of kill everything. And then you have the, you know, and then you have the heavenly beings where suddenly life is wonderful, you know, it's like tomorrow I will never do that again, you know. You have, everything is back into control. You feel like you're wise again, you know, you're compassionate again. And things have cooled out. You look at the world and it looks quite nice. And then, bang, you know. Somebody just stepped on your foot at the wrong time. Down to the inferno, the hell being, burning in hell. And somebody's, you know, at some point you look at something, you know. I mean, we are very much in that world of constant sort of contact, you know. We have all this kind of play on things. That's why the consciousness is compared to, you know. To the one of the five khandhas, the vijnana, is like conjuring tricks. You know, it's always tricking the mind, like a magician, always playing magic on us, and sometimes black magic as well, white magic, because sometimes we believe our stupid, you know, fears. That's what. You know, we believe our fears. That's what I call, quote unquote, black magic. We feel frightened of ourselves. Yeah. So going back to those refuges, you know, these are the awakened mind seeing the Dhamma, the Buddha seeing the Dhamma, and the path of practice that keep that resolve strong, that keeps that the food healthy in the heart, that keep feeding the heart with good food. You know, that's the practice. That's what it is. It's just like a, you know, walking, taking a good diet that will feed the heart nicely, so that you keep on being that awakened mind, seeing the Dhamma, and realizing the ending of suffering, the ending of delusion, the ending of greed and hatred and delusion. And remember the devotion, right? So it's an experience. It's a heart experience. It's not just, you know, thinking about it and working it all out on the brain and sort of getting all the formulas right and all the words and Pali words and, you know, all the sort of Paticchasamuppada and working it all out and thinking you've got it right. But it's a whole, it's a total experience of a whole mind and body and the realization of the awakened heart, the peace, the goodness, the love, the beauty of oneself, which is always there, except it's sometimes buried in the, you know, miles of assumptions of who we think we are. You know, tons, miles, whatever, whichever way you want to look at it. You kind of keep kind of looking in. Which brings me to this image. I can't remember where it comes from, but you probably know it already. You know, it's like when you walk on, you know, when you follow a path, you know, it's like digging a well, right? And you need to dig deep, 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 deep to get to the water. Instead, most of us, we dig a little well here, and then a little well there, and a little well there. We never get to the joy of actually drinking the water, you know. So I really encourage you to dig deeply rather than, you know, become dissatisfied with one thing and then jumping onto another and so on. So it doesn't mean that you can't use other paths or other religion, but don't lose track that all paths are just a mean to come to that place here, to the heart, right here. It's only a means. It's not the end. It's not the end of the story. So if you keep being focused on the means, forgetting, you know, where it's taking you, then you get frustrated. You will never be satisfied with your practice. So make sure you, during this retreat, during this next few days, to you know, develop a real friendship with yourself, a friendship with your heart. And it does not work, it never work unless you have that kind of attitude towards yourself, or being a friend, being kind, but not stupidly kind, not just, you know, doing what you want when you want and just sort of perpetuating habits, but wisely kind, which means knowing when, you know, knowing what is actually supportive and what isn't, you know. And when the deluded habits come into the picture, knowing that hating that habit doesn't work. Pushing it away doesn't work. Ignoring it doesn't work. The only thing that works is that very gently, very kindly following it through until it's gone. So that consciousness is learning how to let things go. It's learning how to let things be, how to let things arise, if it's arise, and how to let them go. So, you know, it's a question of just the right effort, the right, just, you know, I don't have time to go into right effort now, but, you know, it's just a question of bringing, unless I want to test your patience, you know, a gentle effort, just gently navigating through this mass of delusion, which actually when it's seen through, there's nothing there. That's the great news, isn't it? Just bubbles. But it's real as long as you haven't seen through it. You know? It's solid, isn't it? And yet, how many of you, I wish, can have the experience of, you know, having a moment of rage when the whole universe is just like, you just, you know, you're going to tell everybody what you feel. Tell them how you hate them. And then you go and you walk in meditation, you know, and then come back and actually it's gone. And even if you wanted to be in a state of rage again, you can't bring it back up again. It's gone forever. Finished. Died. And it's wonderful, but it's also frightening because we don't want to let things die. So contemplate that, you know, how frightened it is to be, frightening it is for most of us emotionally to be with that truth of change, to be with that reality that things arise and pass away emotionally. It brings up a lot of reactions. So continue to calm your mind, calm your heart, and to see things really clearly, so that by the end of the retreat you have a clear understanding that there's nowhere to go, nothing to do, and nothing to get. So I'll leave you on this.